Welcome to Beauty and the Gi, the podcast about jujitsu and life. I'm Jen Eads, a white belt full of curiosity and questions about all things jujitsu.
And I'm AJ Klingerman, a purple belt, and I'm completely obsessed with jujitsu.
Yes, you are.
Yes, I am.
I think you should do the honors of introducing our guest today.
Okay, so we brought on this super hot guest today, and I know you can't see him, but trust me, he's super hot. my husband, James Klingerman.
Woo! Yay!
Me.
Welcome to Beauty and the Gi.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So today's a very special day for us. Today we celebrate 20 years in business.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It's insane.
Not that old.
I know, right? You definitely don't look it.
No.
There's like rumors going around all of the jiu-jitsu community that James is a vampire.
I can see that.
Yeah. Yeah. Because he has not aged since we opened the school.
Not true.
Maybe body-wise, looks-wise, he looks exactly the same. It's really not fair from the wife perspective.
Right.
He looks the same and I look, you know, 40.
So. No, not really.
No.
You both look like children across the
So would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
No.
No? Okay.
I will. I'm a third degree black belt. I've had my black belt right at 12 years now. So getting close to that fourth, a couple years to go. We've owned and operated Indiana Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Academy for 20 years. And then we also co-own Endurance BJJ. That's where we're at about almost 2 years now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. We have quite a few businesses together. Thefighthub.com. We sell a lot of products. We've got our own instructional DVDs, etc. Also available on streaming and download.
Good.
Every time I say that, everybody's like, nobody buys DVDs anymore.
Not true.
It's not true, number one, but it's also available on digital media. What else?
We run the Ego.
We run the Extreme Grappling Open. Awesome tournament here in Indy 3 times a year. And I don't know, we have a dog, Moose.
Moose is great.
He's our Doberman.
So how did you get started in martial arts?
I don't know. I really don't. So I always tell people I was attracted to it like from day one. You know, when I was a little kid, I wanted to fight. And I probably, like, I was a shy kid, you know, in quotations, like probably today would have been diagnosed with like social anxiety disorder. Like I don't function well in groups. Don't like it. Just thinking about people listening to me talk right now is pretty, it's making me sweat. But when I was like, I don't know, 13 or so, my dad dragged me to a karate class and it sucked. We trained for a while, but it got me into the flow. I was able to kind of go into a group and understood like, okay, I want to do this, not karate necessarily, but I want to learn to fight. And so I found a Japanese judo jiu-jitsu academy and started there. And
here we are.
Here we are. So tell us just about, so March 3rd, 2000.
Yes.
It's a million years ago or 20, but feels like a million. That wasn't ours.
Correct.
To begin with.
Correct.
So tell a little bit about that and yeah, we'll start there.
Okay. Yeah. So, I started Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in 1997 with a guy named Greg Eldred, who was under the Hoist and Orion Association. Met Scott and Eric Sullivan around probably 98, early 99, something like that. And then, so began kind of co-training. So I was, you know, competing, representing, you know, Greg Eldred's Academy, the Gracie Association, but I was training with Scott and Eric Sullivan probably more. So in 99, late 99, I made the official switch over to that team, which was Mario Roberto at the time. And someone talked Eric into opening a jiu-jitsu school.
Because before that, it was in a garage.
Yeah, we were training in his garage. Like, it was not, there was no like public access or anything like that. It was just a few guys that already knew jiu-jitsu, just kind of getting together to train and get better. Once Eric opened the school, March 3rd, 20 years ago, I was one of the assistant instructors. And then later that year, you forced me into opening our own thing. Not really forced, but you were definitely instrumental in making that happen.
So what was that conversation?
First of all, it was the most, like, we'd never talked about it. Never talked about it at all. And I don't know what happened. I literally pulled over on the curb in front of a Taekwondo school. I don't even know if I turned the car off. Like, it was just the weirdest thing. I just ran right in and was like, are you interested in starting a jiu-jitsu program here? No idea why. And he was like, yeah, actually, you know, we've been talking about, you know, having some of our students do some groundwork, and we have a second mat that doesn't get used. And I mean, very tiny little mat space. And that was it. It was, I came home and I was like, hey, this guy's interested in having us come in and start teaching jiu-jitsu. And we basically just sublet the back room and started our jiu-jitsu program there.
You say us, you weren't doing jiu-jitsu at the time.
I wasn't really. I had done a couple of classes in the garage. I did a couple of classes in the, at the, that school, at the Taekwondo school. But I am the national Taekwondo champion choreographer.
Yes.
I'm going to need to hear a little more about that.
So I've never done a day of Taekwondo in my life. We should start there.
Okay.
But the instructor came to me one day knowing I was a dancer, mm-hmm, and just said, would you be interested in choreographing our demo team? And so I did the choreography and they won nationals with it.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Is that why the choreography was so good on that TikTok video that we did?
No, that we stole from TikTok. That was a TikTok dance already.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. No, we stole that.
See, I don't know the cool. Thank you for that clarification.
Yes, yes. But I will post some videos in the near future of some choreography that I've done. So
okay. It just keeps getting better. The more we do this podcast, the more stuff I'm learning.
Right? It's just interesting. Yeah, it was completely crazy that I just stopped and did it. And I came home and I was like, what do you think? Because we were also, so we were living up in northern, like Noblesville, so north of Indianapolis. And the jiu-jitsu school was in Franklin, Indiana.
So
oh my
gosh.
It was a drive. So this was the east side of Indianapolis. It's where we both grew up. We're both familiar with the area. And so it was kind of an in-between. So he would go to Franklin a couple days a week and then teach a couple days a week.
It was a horrible drive either way.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Yeah.
And no podcast then to listen
there was
to.
No
right?
Podcast.
Exactly. We did a lot of books on tape, though. We really
a lot
did.
Of Tony Robbins cassette tapes. And
yep. Yeah, definitely.
You stopped in two schools that day.
Did I really?
Yeah. So you said you stopped in two places. And the one guy basically was like, get out.
I blocked that.
He's like,
he stuck me.
He's like, jiu-jitsu sucks. You suck. You're a horrible person. Leave my dojang.
Yep. Must have blocked that out. That's never happened.
So were you all in with this when she came home and was like,
you know, I don't remember, honestly. I was like, oh, yeah, I'll go talk to the guy, see what's up. And, you know, I remember emailing my head instructor, Mario, our black belt, I emailed him. I was like, hey, I kind of got this opportunity. Are you cool with this? And I talked to Eric, who was the owner of Indiana Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And I was like, hey, can I start another branch? What should I call it? And he's like, just use our logo, use the name. Like, he was super cool. And Eric is a phenomenal human being. Love that guy. But, it's pretty much how it happened. We just like, I was like, okay, logo. Like we just kind of had everything in place because we use the same name, use the same logo. And then Eric actually ended up moving from Franklin into like a warehouse that
up
his
here.
Brother
it
owned.
It was at 71st in Michigan.
Yeah.
So it was kind of up by our Zionsville school.
Yeah. And then after it didn't last long.
So what made you think, oh, we should do a second school? Did AJ come home with that idea too?
Oh, for Zionsville?
Yeah.
No, that was much longer. We really skipped ahead in some time frame here. We actually had two schools for a while.
Okay.
Which was also a weird thing.
From the Taekwondo school, we were there about 2.5 years. And then the owner of the Taekwondo Academy came and he's like, hey, we actually bought this building. It's much bigger. It's a fantastic building. He tells me like how phenomenal this building is. And then he says, but there's only one floor. So there's no room for you anymore. And I was like, okay, well, you know, how long? And he's like, oh, you've got 2 weeks to be out.
we
had to close our academy. So one of my students let me teach out of his garage for 2 months while we found a building to lease.
Oh, wow.
So we ended up moving down to Greenwood, which we're still at. So we've been in Greenwood like over 15 years now. Yeah. So I taught in out of a garage for 2 months. I mean, it basically just wiped the academy out. Like we pretty much had to start all over when we moved to Greenwood. And then, so yeah, I ran there for years. And then one of my kind of students, kind of like old school training partners came to me and is like, "Hey, I got an opportunity to start a jiu-jitsu school. Will you come look at this place? Tell me what you think, blah, blah, blah." So we get there. And it is the exact same building the original IBJJ was in, like the same suite
the same
and everything.
Suite. Yeah, it was
still
the
had
same,
our heavy
no
bag
kidding.
Mounts,
our
like
mounts
everything.
Yeah.
And which you know, he once we got there, he was like, "Oh, I didn't realize it was the exact same spot." And we looked at it, and I was like, "Yeah, I think you know." We talked about it. I was like, "I think we can help you out. Like that would be great." The next day, he backed out.
Oh no!
And AJ and I were like, "You know what? It's so cheap. We can do this." And so we went ahead and opened a second location and we had instructors down there. We would, you know, go down sometimes. What did we run? We ran it for about 4 years, right?
Yeah.
And then it got to the point where like no one cared about it as much as we did. You mm-hmm. know, guys would show up to teach class and then they would leave and it was, the guys were supposed to be cleaning. Like the paid janitor wasn't cleaning and
oh, wow.
they were all kind of like not telling on each other type uh-huh. deal. So. And they kind of created like a us versus them culture. Like instead of it being one team, one academy, it was like a Southside versus, you know,
yeah.
versus James.
Yeah. And it was also Indiana Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Academy. Like we kept the name. It didn't have a different name. So yeah, there was a very us versus them kind of mentality. It was funny though, because like we went in 1 week span from not wanting a second location to partnering that we were going to get a second location to like opening a second location in a week. Like it was just a whirlwind and it was good. Like we, you know, we met a lot of people, we got new students from it that then moved to Greenwood once yeah. we closed that place. But all in all, it was a headache. it was a lot of work. And so how we ended up with Endurance, James's first black belt owned Endurance. He opened it and then fell in love. And wanted to move to Maryland. So he asked us if we wanted to buy it.
And we said no.
No. No.
I was like, "Not a chance, homie. I'll give you some money for the pads and the mats. I'll buy all your equipment, but I don't yeah. want the school."
And then we were kind of talked into yes. And then you were doing some consulting work.
And I talked a guy out of opening another school.
And I overheard him on the phone. And when he hung up, we were both like, "Oh yeah, no, we forgot. That's why we don't want a second school." And so we were back to no for a while.
And then, you know, we talked money. And then it kind of boiled down to like, we had all these students that would have no home.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was like, man, that sucks. So that was why we wanted to figure it out. It wasn't a money thing. It was like, we want these people to have a home.
Yeah.
And then one of my black belts, Daryl, came to me and was like, "Hey man, I actually kind of want to open my own school." And he was teaching for me full time in Greenwood.
Mm.
He was like our head kickboxing coach and, you know, one of my black belts that taught the jiu-jitsu when I wasn't around. And I said, "Well, how about instead of you opening a place, we just move you over here? You know, this is happening." And he said, "Nope."
Yep. He said
and
no.
kind of walked out and he seemed real mad.
Oh my gosh.
And I was like, "I don't know what I just did to make him angry." But then he called me an hour later and was like, "It would be my honor." So. But yeah, he's doing a great job up there.
Yeah. Yeah. He just had to, he wanted to talk it over with his family and everything to make sure. But yeah, so it all went back and forth a lot before we decided that yes, it would be a good idea for us to have a second place. And it's not always easy, not to be, you know, whatever, but probably hardest on me mm-hmm. just because I teach at both academies several days a week. You know, like
yeah.
I do the most back and forth, but I don't regret it at all. Like I love it. I love teaching up there.
It's going really well. We love the yeah. people. And
yeah. Yeah. So
we've actually moved from the original building we were in. We moved onto the main street. We've got a much bigger, much nicer place. We've increased the academy, the attendance and everything by quite a bit.
I don't know that I ever would have started if you weren't in
right.
Zionsville.
Right, yeah.
Greenwood's far. It's for something that you don't know if you're going to like it.
Yeah. And I mean, like, you'll make the trip to Greenwood now to train, but you might not have had you not already had the bug.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I don't think it ever would have happened.
Yeah.
Because I think we'd talked about me doing it. And then when you had Zionsville, I was like, oh, well, that's really close. So there, there goes that excuse now. Thanks.
Aren't you glad?
I'm so glad. Thanks for buying a school there to get me started.
You're very welcome. I did it just for you. But I mean, like, he's right. Like, we wanted, you know, those were our teammates. We didn't want them to end up dispersed or quitting jujitsu or anything like that. We wanted them to have a home.
How has it been growing the business from 20 years ago? Was there any other, I mean, other than garages in Indiana, was there really any that many other places to train?
No, not really. I mean, we were the first in central Indiana to have a full-time academy. You know, like I said, Greg, my first jiu-jitsu coach, he's like an engineer or something. He's still got like a really nice job. He, at the time, was teaching twice a week out of a like a basement for an insurance place in Westfield.
Oh, wow.
It was a tiny little room, probably not even as big as the room we're in. Tiny little room just in a basement. So I drive an hour plus up there a couple times a week, you know. And so there really wasn't like, you know, you see karate schools and strip malls everywhere, but there was no jiu-jitsu like that anywhere. So we had the first actual like jiu-jitsu business in Indianapolis. But yeah, we didn't know anything about business at all.
Like,
I was like, guys, I teach jiu-jitsu. Come do jiu-jitsu. Everybody wants to do jiu-jitsu. Like, it's the fastest growing sport in the world. Why aren't you doing jiu-jitsu? And you know, I taught MMA and kickboxing and all the things, you know, and it just, people just weren't coming in. And some people would come in and go, oh, this is hard. I thought I could just do a kata and look in the mirror and like do some dance moves and I'd be Van Damme. And
well, people didn't really know, like, you know, so one, we could get people from 2.5 hours away to drive to us because they knew what jiu-jitsu was.
Right.
So they knew the value of James and his teaching. So people would drive from far away, but nobody in the neighborhood behind us was coming.
Right.
You know, like, because people just didn't know what jiu-jitsu was.
Yeah.
So like, you should, the family that came in to learn jiu-jitsu.
Oh, yeah. So this was after we had moved out of the Taekwondo school. We're down in, this is also like, probably I wasn't the best at talking to people and getting them to do jiu-jitsu.
Like, yeah, we've come a long way.
Yeah, you know. But so I'm in the middle teaching class one night, and good sized class. And
For the time.
Like, and this family's a mother and her son and daughter. They come in, and so we had a very small lobby, no seats or anything. So they're like, hey, we're interested in jiu-jitsu. And I said, well, you know, I just started the jiu-jitsu class. You guys can come around here. So I had them like sit on a heavy bag on the mat. And I was like, you know, my name's James. If you have any questions, feel free to just kind of flag me down and ask. And so I teach a couple moves, people are drilling, and she had maybe asked me a question or something. And I don't know, we get about 20, 25 minutes into class and she flags me over and she's like, hey, when does the jiu-jitsu start? And I was like, this is the jiu-jitsu class. And she's like, oh. And she just stares at me and they're kind of looking at each other. And I was like, we seem confused. Like, what, you know, what can I help you with? And she goes, well, we just saw The Matrix. And in that, he says that he learns jiu-jitsu. Where did they do jiu-jitsu in that? And I was like, they actually didn't. And she's like, oh, what did they do? And I was like, they did like a movie. Like, they were inside a, I was like, they were in a computer.
That's not real.
But, I was like, oh yeah, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, you know, for an extra $250 a month, I can tie some like wires to the ceiling and I can push you across. And she was like, nope.
Oh my gosh.
I'm like, okay, well.
So they're not students.
We always do a 30-day free trial. Where are you going? Bye.
What do you think's been that tipping point then that people are now like, oh, jiu-jitsu, I want to go try this out?
I don't know. So MMA, obviously, you know.
Yeah, but the Ultimate Fighter.
Yeah, the Ultimate Fighter, big time. Just MMA is a lot more widespread now. You know, back in the day, it was called NHB, and it was kind of underground. And like, you know, there was one UFC a year, maybe. And now there's like three a week, and you can't keep track of them. And but it, you know, it's on every major network, and it's on pay per view, and it's on online, and everybody's talking about it. And you know, we're talking about it on this podcast, and so it's much more popular now. But also jiu-jitsu is kind of at the point now where it's kind of becoming popular as well, mm-hmm. aside from MMA. It used to be you did jiu-jitsu to fight, right? And now jiu-jitsu is kind of this growing sport on its own, and jiu-jitsu by itself is becoming more popular, and then the no-gi stuff's becoming more popular. There's guys making big money in events like EBI and Abu Dhabi, and then they get popular and they're teaching. So it's just a lot more mainstream now than it was 20 years, even 10 years ago.
Yeah, I might have heard of it before you, but then I was like, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's a big thing, you know, like the big differences are there's, you know, so much more to the internet.
Right.
I mean, you know, when we were first, like there really wasn't YouTube when James was first doing jiu-jitsu.
YouTube used to have like a 14 second video limit. Like it was,
oh my gosh.
Like it was almost like just like the
Vine
little clips.
Or something. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like Vine,
but not that popular. And then, you know, like we had web TV was our internet. So it wasn't like we were really getting to like watch videos.
Yeah.
Same with like the podcasts and even just, you know, I post all the time about our women's training. So mm-hmm. people are, you know, they see it, they feel more comfortable with it, they understand a little bit more about what it is. Mm-hmm. So it's really helped it to grow for sure. And talking about, you know, helping to spread the word and talking about all the different reasons you might do jiu-jitsu. Like people might think that you do jiu-jitsu to fight. Mm-hmm. And that's just not why most people do it anymore. Do you know that the fastest growing demographic right now in jiu-jitsu is women between 40 and 45 starting jiu-jitsu?
My people.
Right?
Yeah.
That is awesome. Like women starting jiu-jitsu between 40 and 45 is the fastest growing demographic.
That means I'm going to get some fights.
Right? I think that's so cool. I think that's really cool. So everyone that's like, man, I'm too old to start that. You're not. You're just not.
Well, and I think too, like at that age, there was no wrestling in high school for girls.
Yeah.
And I mean, I remember when I started playing basketball, like Y basketball, there was no girls team on Y basketball yet. Like if you wanted to play, you played on the boys team.
Yeah.
And you showed up and you just played.
Did it. Yeah.
Like, that was it. And that's so awesome.
Yeah.
There's
and
so
I
much
love
opportunity.
How much like the girls wrestling is growing.
Yeah.
Like we have a lot of girls that are out of jiu-jitsu right now because they're in wrestling season. That's amazing. That would have never been a thing 5 years ago. And now all these girls are wrestling and they're going to grow up and do jiu-jitsu and murder all of us.
Yeah. My mom was horrified that I would play football at recess. I can't imagine if I came home and said, I want to do jiu-jitsu.
Right.
And it looks a lot like wrestling, mom, but we wear pajamas. It's fine.
And we choke people and try to break their limbs.
Yeah. It's way more awesome.
I'll never forget my mom going, what happened to my little dancer? Well,
it's just a different kind of choreography.
It's just different. And one thing, you know, like just from the female perspective that I really like about jiu-jitsu versus like growing up in dance, jiu-jitsu is very body positive. Like
mm-hmm.
you use your body, it's a weapon, you know, like, but dance was, you've got to be smaller. We're going to order these costumes too small for you so that you have to lose weight to fit into them.
Oh my gosh.
You know, like just stuff like that. That uh-huh. just, you know, there's a lot more body positivity in jiu-jitsu. I like that a lot.
Yeah, I do too. Like I've crushed it. I've
people.
Got it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to use it.
Exactly. Exactly. I was doing a kind of like semi-private the other day with two girls and, you know, the one girl outweighs me. And so she's like trying to be real light on her partner. And I was like, I guarantee you will never be as heavy as me. Like,
yeah,
you can try to be as heavy as you want. I will still feel heavier.
Right. I will attest to that.
Yes. Right?
Yes. So what made you randomly pull over and ask this guy about starting jiu-jitsu there?
At that point in time, James wasn't working. He was on disability from an incident that had happened just a week and a half before the grand opening of the school. So it was leap year, which means it was 9, 10, 11, 12 days before. So 12 days before the first IBJJA opened, James had gotten shot in the head. And so it was just a real wake-up call of like, life's too short.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to be working in a factory all your life. It's not what you want to do. So let's figure out what we can do different, you know? And I think it was, I think we opened the school in August, which was right when you went back to work. So it was just, you know, like, let's start working on what we want our life to be like.
You're working full time.
Mm-hmm.
James has been shot.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to open this school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how are you managing all of that? Because that's just giving me anxiety thinking about it.
Well, first of all, I worked for Charles Schwab at the time.
Okay.
I was their youngest stockbroker they'd ever had, which was, I liked saying way more than I liked doing.
Uh-huh.
it's a slightly stressful job, but amazing company to work for. They were so good. And they had this thing called a time for giving where other people donated me their sick time and their vacation time that I could help James, like, do his surgeries, do all his doctor's appointments. Like, I didn't miss anything. Also, like, opening the school was basically just consisted of James going and teaching classes because we didn't know anything else.
Right.
Like, we knew nothing, even though I took business classes in high school and the 1 year of college I did, we knew nothing about running a business. So it was literally just like, if you build it, they will come.
Uh-huh.
That's what we thought.
Yeah.
You know, like, surely.
Right.
So, you know, all of the stuff that I do now, if I worked a full-time job too, it would be crazy. But then it was just, he went and taught classes and people paid or didn't. And because we were paying like a percentage of what we were bringing in, it would always be cash positive.
Oh, nice.
So it was easy.
Yeah.
So that kind of took a lot of the stress away. And then it was giving him something that he enjoyed doing. And yeah, kind of building. The one thing I always knew is that I wanted to own my own business. Like growing up, I thought it was a dance studio. I thought I wanted to own a dance school. Jiu-jitsu is not that much different. It's just, you know, primarily adults instead of children. And it's primarily men instead of women. Those are the big differences.
Right.
But other than that, it's pretty much the same. So I always knew I wanted to own my own business. So it just kind of put us on that path. Yeah. So it wasn't, that part wasn't really that stressful.
Okay, that's great, because that is completely not what I expected. I would just be like, well, I'd be a mess.
We were young too, remember?
Well,
like,
yeah.
Right? So
yeah.
we were too ignorant to be stressed about it. Now, flash forward a little bit. And, you know, we lost everything to keep the school open because we were young and ignorant and didn't know what we were doing. And so I was working full time plus some part time jobs. James was working, you know, his job, part-time jobs, all that, you know, we were doing everything we could to keep the school open, but we lost everything. We lost our house. We lost his car. We were taking cold showers because we couldn't afford our gas bill, like literally. And when we had to leave that Taekwondo school and open up a place of our own, which no longer had that safety net of just, you know, paying a percentage of what we made, we had a conversation and I was like, I'm willing to give up everything but you for this. You know, like, our relationship cannot be a problem, but whatever else doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's what it took. It took us giving up everything. So then, yes, that was a very stressful time because we still didn't really know how to run a business or build a business or, you know, any of that stuff. We just knew how to work really hard and put everything we had back into the business. And so we were lucky. My stepdad had a little teeny tiny house for us to rent. So
small.
So we went from like 1,750 square feet to about 700 square feet. And we were there for several years while we got our act together.
At any point in time, were you like, I'm done? I'm just going to go back to work for man.
I don't think so.
No.
I will tell you, like, I told the story to somebody the other day, but waking up in that tiny little house every day was just a reminder of what had happened. And it was it was almost motivating. Like, literally, I'd wake up every morning for 7.5 years and I'd go, I hate where I'm at. I hate being here. It was just... it was terrible. But, you know, we met we met our coach, Scott, turned our lives around. Like, he really showed us how to start running a business, like a business, and how to actually make some money doing what we love doing.
Right.
But it was in that 7.5 years when we were able to kind of like really turn our lives around, you know. And even though I hated being there, I was like, oh, well, we're actually not going to be here forever. I can,
we can see the light.
We can see the light. So,
and we knew like we were already in far enough into the academy that we saw people's lives changing. Mm-hmm. You know, we had already heard like a guy who, you know, called and was like, honestly, the intro class just saved my life. Like, you know, just little stuff like that, that it was just like, this is where we're supposed to be. And even though like things are kind of falling down around us, this is what we're supposed to be doing. We just have to keep pushing forward.
So let's go back to the intro class saved that guy's life, because I don't know if jiu-jitsu could save my life right now.
Well, depends on, I guess, who you...
Exactly.
So he did the intro, and he might have even done another class, but one day he was just like, hey, man, like, I work loss prevention, and he's like, what if somebody has a weapon? What mm-hmm. if somebody has a knife? And we sat down and worked, man, not maybe 20, 30 minutes just on, like, just control, like, just some really simple basics, none of this, like, crazy, like... you know, waving the knife and flipping it and re-stabbing them. And it was like, you know, just some like, hey, let's get a hold of the wrist. Let's get into this position where we can effectively control the situation. And sure enough, like, I don't know how many weeks went by. And he had been to a couple classes, you know, within that time frame, but someone shoplifted. He tried to stop them and they pulled a knife and attacked him.
Oh my gosh.
And he was able to control the knife, take the fight to the ground, dominate the position where he could not be attacked, and was able to hold the person down until the police were able to come and arrest him.
That's amazing.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, all right, you know, it's just, you know, not that that's little stuff, but like it was those kind of things that we were just like, all right, we can't stop.
You would think he would join the academy after an amazing experience like that.
Right.
But he didn't.
He knew all he needed to know. He knew he could defend against a knife attack. What more did he need?
Right. Saved your life after 2 weeks, man. Imagine what 2 years will do.
No kidding.
Well, people are interesting. We've talked about it briefly on the podcast before, but I would like for people to hear from you what you kind of grade on from a like promotion standpoint. So we don't do testing at the school. I always say, you know, Coach James works with you. He knows when you're ready to level up. So I'd like to have you kind of talk through that.
Yeah. So I always talk about four pillars, kind of six, but the main four: time in, level of knowledge, how well do you roll, how well do you compete. So one thing is with those pillars, like if one is weak, the other three have to compensate. If two are weak, the other two have to really, really compensate. So time in, you know, like I typically with us, white to blue takes about 12 to 24 months. So 18 months on average. Then the other belts, you know, there's blue to purple is always the longest belt, purple to brown, brown to black. You know, there's years in between those typically.
So time in.
Yeah.
Why is blue to purple the longest typically?
Blue belt's kind of where you, at blue belt, you have a decent foundation and then you kind of expand on that foundation. So, you know, I'm a firm believer in having a strong foundation. The stronger your foundation, the higher you can build a building, right? Like mm-hmm. the taller the skyscraper, the deeper the basement. So that blue belt, getting to blue and then blue to purple is kind of like building the foundation and then mastering the foundation. And then you're adding to it along those lines. But that's why there's a lot of talk. People think there should be another belt in there to kind of like chop up that like white, blue, purple area. But just be a blue belt for a while. You know, So I tell people I had my blue for 4 years, pretty much to the date, like 4 years to the month. I competed in every tournament possible. I went 2 years without even losing a match. At one point, maybe a few like open weights, but like in my weight, like I won every tournament I went to for two solid years. And that was year two to three, or one. Yeah. From 1 year in to 3 years in. So I still had another whole year before I ever even got promoted again.
Oh, wow.
You know, and that was training 6 days a week. Like, my students don't train as hard as I trained when I was a blue belt. They don't compete as much as I competed when I was a blue belt, for the most part, you know. The blue belt's just, it's just a long belt. It's just, I don't know, it's how it is.
It's a lot to live up to, guys. It's a lot to live up to.
6 days a week, compete every weekend for 4 years.
I do
my
best.
You might get a stripe. Maybe a stripe. But yeah. Oh, so yeah, time in, level of knowledge. Obviously, like anything, you have to know the techniques. You have to be able to teach it. You know, you can roll great and that's fine. But if you can't show somebody a basic move or have an idea of what you're actually trying to do, then you're not going to get ranked, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Rolling, obviously, you know, jiu-jitsu is not like some of the other martial arts. Like in traditional martial arts, you can do your katas and you can kind of know the moves, but never, not one single time ever put them into practice. So you never have to actually hit anybody or get kicked or anything, and you can get a black belt. Jiu-jitsu is not like that. Jiu-jitsu, you have to be able to use it effectively against someone who also knows it. Or at least against somebody that doesn't know it, maybe. I don't know. But you've got to be able to use it. And then, you know, when I started jiu-jitsu, it was to compete. And that's what everybody was. Like, if you were one of the guys that didn't compete, you were the weirdo. You know?
Really?
Oh, yeah. Like, if somebody was like, I don't think I want to compete, you're like, oh, well, then we don't want to train with you because something's wrong. I don't know. You have an infection or something. I don't want to touch you. But, you know, it was like everybody in the room did jiu-jitsu to compete in some form or another. And it's not like that now at all. You know, mm-hmm. like probably 80% of our people don't want to compete, but I force them to. They're going to.
You don't force them to.
I do. At least once. At least once or twice.
Yeah.
Per year. So now we have a lot of guys that don't compete, a lot of guys and girls. Yeah, probably.
Yeah. I mean, my women mostly compete.
But, you know, so competition is usually that one that's either super strong or super weak. So if you go out and you compete and you smash everybody, you can get away with not being the most technical guy in the world. If you go out and compete and you lose constantly, well, you're going to have a little more technical knowledge. You're going to take a little longer between belts.
That's me.
And then, you know, we pillar 5 and 6 are just continual improvement. Like, you know, we're all going to get to that point where we're not able to physically improve. We're not getting faster. You know, I'm 40 now. So like I'm getting slower and weaker by the day, and I'm super slow and weak already. So, but I'm always trying to learn new jiu-jitsu. I'm always trying to make what I already know better. And then number 6 is just don't be a turd bag. Like just be a decent human being. And oddly enough, that's super hard for people. Like,
yeah, that might be the hardest.
Yeah, moral compass. So, I mean, ideally, we wouldn't want anyone to, you know, carry a high rank under us or under him, but, you know, that, mm-hmm. that flies his flag.
Yeah.
That isn't a good person.
Right.
So, you know, on rare occasion, someone might slip through the cracks or someone might change deep in, but typically, like, that's, you know, those types of people don't make it that far with us, so.
What are you working on right now as part of your continuous
improvement? Me personally?
Yeah.
So I'm doing a lot of 50-50 stuff right now. And then I'm working in deep half. So deep half guard is like it's the one thing I've just never really sat down and messed with a ton. I've got a handful of moves and that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm doing some deep half stuff. And then deep half into 50-50. And then we've been working a little bit of the little chair sweep, the Carolina, I think it's called. Just some stuff with that also working into 50-50. So that's about it. Top-wise, still doing some high-collar passing stuff. My DVD should be out.
We'll have a link to that in the show notes.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
What else?
I really like the high-collar passing. That's some of my favorite stuff.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of that. But the DVD's filmed, so like...
Yeah. So now you need to like move on to whatever's next for
I'm trying to. That's funny. This is why you write your game plan down, ladies and gentlemen.
Right.
Mm-hmm. How do you decide what you're going to work on next?
Well, sometimes something fun just falls in my lap and I go, that's what I'm going to do. Other times I have a glaring weakness, like deep half. So, you know, people come to me with questions and I'm like, I don't know the answer. So I guess I'm doing deep half guard for the next 6 months, you know? But you know, so like with stuff like that, like I'll go to trusted people, you know, deep half, you know, guys like the Mendez brothers, Ryan Hall, guys like that. I'll look at some of their instructionals, and I will tell you, like, typically if I watch instructional, very rarely do I mimic their game.
Mm-hmm.
I'll see what their concepts are. I might steal a technique here and there, but I just kind of put it into my own game.
Yeah.
Like I go, well, yes, I see all these things you're doing, but I'm going to do those things that fit into the way I already play. So typically what, you know, I throw a bunch of like different instructionals into my little blender and what comes out is completely different.
James has an amazing memory too. Like, I'm pretty sure if you asked him about nationals in 1998 in California, he could tell you every match.
Of mine, yes.
Right, yours.
Not yeah, of the whole yeah, tournament.
Not of the whole tournament, but of yours. Like, step by step, everything that happened, it's insanity. I don't have a memory like that. I really wish I did. Like, I'll come off the mat after a match and James will be like, what happened? I'll be like, I don't know.
I think I just blocked mine out.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes just your emotional state during the match. When it's a slow match and you're winning and you're calm, it's easy to remember everything that happens. But when it's like a high intensity, yeah, like I hurt my back and I want out of this match the whole time. And, you know, you stop focusing on what's happening or you turn into like that survival mode where that's mm-hmm. what you're thinking of is like, just don't die.
Yeah.
It's much harder to remember, you know, I had a match in 97 and honestly, I can remember bits of the match, but what I remember is just pain. This guy, like literally, like I always say, it reminded me of the old Tom and Jerry cartoons when like Jerry's the mouse, right? When he gets like the super potion and he's a muscular mouse and he like grabs Tom and just like, bomb, bomb, bomb. That's what this match felt like. The guy chipped like six of my teeth. Like it was, I hurt my shoulder. Like he manhandled me. I remember sweeping him into mount one time. And other than that, I just remember him like crushing me and I don't know what happened. Like
oh
it
gosh.
Was horrible. I lost. I know that.
So, I mean, we're a little longer into our normal format, but you brought up emotional state during a match. And I know, obviously, that you've had some issues with anxiety that you didn't even have until you were a black belt. And I also know how much you telling that story to our students has helped them through some things. So I'd like for you to kind of talk about, like, how did the anxiety start? How did you get past it?
Oh, yeah, I do know. I was like, I don't know when it started. I do. I can pinpoint exactly the day it started.
Same.
So I was on an airplane flying to Florida via Pennsylvania or something. I don't even know where it was going. But I was going actually to get certified as an Abu Dhabi referee. And we get to cruising altitude and I was like, man, my ear hurts really bad. I had a little ear infection getting on the plane. Didn't think much of it. Starts burning, burning, burning. I'm like doubled over, just holding my face. And then all of a sudden, no pain. And I was like, cool. And then I realized I couldn't move my face. My whole left side of my face was completely paralyzed. Couldn't close my eye. Like I'm drooling. I'm like, oh my God, like I just had a stroke. So I do a little stroke test, you know, moving my hands, getting them above my head. You know, I'm like, okay, I'm answering all the questions. I take my pulse. I'm like, not a stroke. I had an ear infection. Cabin pressure pushed the infection in. You know, it pinched my seventh cranial nerve. I've got Bell's palsy. Like I completely justified it. I understood exactly what was happening. I was like, no big deal. I turned to the guy next to me who was with me and also a huge part of my stress. And I was like, hey, it wasn't very clear, but I was like, I'm not having a stroke. I'm going to go rinse my face off. I'm fine. So I'm rinsing my face off. I'm kind of looking at it and I'm like, everything will be okay. No big deal. I'm not panicked at all. Completely calm. I come out, I'm talking to the flight attendant, telling her what's going on, but I can hear the guy like, you know, he got shot in the face and he's like kind of telling her. And so I come out, I was like, hey, I'm okay. No big deal. This is what's happening. And then I'm kind of laughing about it, you know, and then all of a sudden I get real dizzy and I was like, whoa. So I sit down and then my heart rate starts going. And then I'm like, just things are going haywire. And I was like, this is horrible. So they break, like, you know, we're on a plane. So they've got the defibrillator out and they're like, I don't mean to scare you, but just in case. And I'm like, you're fine, whatever. And, like I'm like pouring sweat and like they had ice on my neck and ice on my hands and they had oxygen on me and I'm just sitting there and I remember like everything going black. Like it was like when you get choked and you're starting to black out, like that's what was happening. And I was just like, this is it. Like I'm probably going to die. We are 40 minutes from landing. Like
I'm literally
going to be dead on this plane. And I remember like the second everything went dark, boom, I snapped out of it. And I was like, oh my God, I'm freezing. Get this ice off me. And
oh my gosh.
And like vision came back. I was kind of normal. My face was still kind of numb. And they came and they sat with me and they were like filling out paperwork and stuff. And as I was talking to the girl, and you know, my speech was real slurry. And then it just kind of gradually cleared up and everything went away.
So you weren't on that flight.
No, no. So imagine like, you know, getting a call from like, right. You know.
So I called her from the ambulance from the as ambulance. Soon as we landed.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, like obviously I wasn't with him when he got shot either. Mm-hmm. So now after this, I never want to let him out of my sight.
Right.
You know, like,
yeah.
But yeah, the hospital I went to, the guy was just like, ah, it's your sinuses. And I'm like, this has never happened before. Are you crazy?
And was it all as a result of the ear infection then?
So I think so. They couldn't pinpoint it. And the doctor was like, you don't have an ear infection. I'm like, well, I had one when I got on the plane.
Yeah.
And he's like, no way. And I'm like, no, I'm telling you. Uh-huh. So I'm sure it's what it pushed it in. It affected the nerve in my head.
Wow.
But so I called, my surgeon, the guy that my nose and throat doctor. And he's like, yes, it could be the sinuses, you know, because of the pressure they could be pinching that nerve, blah, blah, blah. So we had to walk like 3 miles in the snow because that hospital doesn't have a pharmacy and get nose spray.
Oh my gosh.
And the nose spray was enough to clear it up. And I was okay. So made it, did all that, made it back to the airport in time to get on my next flight to Florida, which was a longer one.
Oh, and he didn't have a coat in Pennsylvania because he was going to Florida.
Right.
So he didn't have a coat when he was walking around.
But after that, I kept having like anxiety attacks and I didn't know what was happening. Like, you know, we were like, man, am I stroking out? Like my hair's always standing on edge. Like I'm like jittery. Like I felt like I was on drugs. You know, I was like kind of like tweaking out all the time. I was like, I'm not like pacing in the driveway.
Oh my gosh.
Like it just got bad for a while. Yeah. So I didn't fly for years and years and years. And then even once I started flying again, I would still have that. Mm-hmm. Like we'd hit cruising altitude and my face would start going numb and I would have to, you know, I still to this day, I keep sinus spray and eardrops on me. And I've never had, it's been years since I've even had a little bit of an issue, but I make sure my sinuses are clear.
He just recently took his first flight without me since that one a decade ago or more, well over a decade ago. So I was a little nervous having him fly without me, but it went fine.
I was good.
Well, I think you were pretty motivated to make that trip.
Yes.
Yeah, so why don't you tell us about that trip a little bit?
Yeah. So one of my very absolute favorite bands is Tool, the lead singer of Tool, also lead singer of Perfect Circle, Pussifer. He's been in a bunch of bands. A guy named Maynard James Keenan does jiu-jitsu. He actually owns a jiu-jitsu school down in Arizona, blah, blah, blah. He owns like 7,000 businesses. But I've always just kind of had like this little bucket list. Like, I'd like to train with Maynard. That would be really cool for me. You know, it was like a selfish jiu-jitsu thing, right? And so I've tried a couple times. Like a good friend of mine, Dan Camarillo, Dan's buddies with him. Maynard always trains with like Dan and his brother, Dave. And Dan hit me up the other day and was like, Tool's just here.
Mm-hmm.
And I messaged Maynard on Facebook on his little account. And I was like, hey, bro, I'm Dan's buddy if you want to train. And, you know, he didn't get back with me. I'm like, whatever. So Dan calls me. He's like, hey, Maynard just hit me up and wants a private before the Tool concert in Fresno, California. I was like, I didn't even reply. Mm-hmm. Like, I was just mad because I couldn't go. I was like, not. So he waited like 4 or 5 hours and then he just replies, "Are you dead?" I was like, "No, I just can't make it." And he's like, "Well, I haven't asked yet." And so he's like, "Figure out if you can make it or not." So I was like, "Okay." So AJ and I talked and we're like, "You know what? I can make it. Like, yeah. No big deal. I can make it out there."
No way was I not going to make sure he got out there. No way.
So I text Dan back. I was like, you know, ask him, make sure it's cool. And then I'll go ahead and make it out there. And like, I mean, I don't even think 2 minutes went by and Dan sends me a thing like, you know, yeah, hey, that'd be great. So book a flight, fly out there. Dan picks me up at the airport, crash his place. He actually worked a half day the next day. So we about lunchtime, head out, eat lunch, get to the venue. We went to the mall for a little bit first and walked around.
Important information.
Important part of the story. Dan's cool. I like hanging out with him. But yeah, I get to the venue and, met the head security guy who I'd actually seen fight multiple times. Like, he used to fight in Indiana.
Oh, wow.
So, we knew a lot of the same people and stuff. And then we go in this little back room and Maynard comes in already in full gi and everything. And we do a little lesson. Dan taught. I mainly just got choked and armbarred.
Nice.
Got to show him a few things. He did put me out at one point. At the end, he was videoing like what he had gone over. And one of them just, it was side control, moving to north and south, good shoulder pressure on the neck, moving into the armbar. And he's doing it super slow because he's like kind of talking his way through it for the video. And I'm super relaxed because I'm just laying there being the dummy. And I was like, oh, wow, his shoulder's tight. I'm kind of fading. I was like, well, he'll get to the armbar soon. I'll be good. And then he goes for the armbar and I'm like, oh, I kind of wake up a little bit. And there was just this moment of like, oh, it was all a dream. No, it's not. I was like, dude, you totally had me out.
Oh my gosh.
But yeah, super cool guy. Just he seemed very down to earth, like real cool. Enjoyed the jiu-jitsu lesson. We got some cool like backstage passes. We got great seats to the concert. Like,
nice.
It was amazing. Definitely one of my jiu-jitsu selfish highlights, I guess.
So real fast, just kind of going back to the anxiety thing. Mm-hmm. I want you to talk specifically about the bullpen when you had that moment. I think that's...
So number one, before the bullpen even, I was sitting around the house one day and I was thinking about the anxiety attacks because, you know, people kept saying, oh, you're having panic attacks, you're having anxiety attacks. And I was like, I'm the most like calm person you've ever met in your life. Even my doctor was like, you are not the type. And I was like, I'm not. Like, I don't get anxious. I don't get, you know, this doesn't happen to me, right? Mm-hmm. I'm better than that.
Side note, I had panic attacks, you know, in the past and it's nothing you would ever wish on someone else, but something you're kind of almost relieved, like, now you understand.
Right.
Now you get it. Like, yeah. So it's an interesting dynamic.
But yeah, I was sitting there and I was like, just kind of thinking about the panic attack, and I started getting dizzy and I started blacking out my hair. I was like, oh. And then it was like, I just did that to myself. Mm-hmm. I just forced myself into this panic attack. Like, I thought it and I gave myself a chemical imbalance, like, you know, it was mind over matter in the wrong direction. And so I sat there and I just pulled myself out of it.
How did you do that?
I just said, don't be a sissy. Like, legitimately, like, it was like, don't be weak. You're being a weak person. Stop being a weak person. Ultimately. I just kind of rationalized. I was like, you just did this to yourself. Mm-hmm. There's nothing here. Like, just calm down, breathe, a lot of breathing. And I pulled myself out of it and I was like, cool. So I sat for a minute, kind of shook it off. I was like, man, I feel good. Okay. Let's do it again. Started thinking about it. I forced it a little deeper that time. Did all the same stuff. Breathe, happy thoughts. Don't be a punk. Pulled myself out of it. So I sat and I did it 6 times. And each time I let myself get deeper and deeper into it until like that 6th time, I almost couldn't make myself go into it anymore. But I was like, holy smokes. Like, this revelation, right? Like I'm doing this to myself. It's not some weird outside anything. It's literally all in my head, and I have absolute control over what's in my head. So I cleared it. Like I didn't have them for a long time. And then I would have them pretty much only like every once in a while, it'd be something weird. Like I would be standing there talking to somebody and I'm blacking out for no reason at all, you know?
Oh my gosh.
But like it was, you know, it was one of those things where it was happening every day. And then it went to like once every 6 months or something. But I was having them when I would compete. Just be, you know, now I've got all this crazy external stress and also flying. Once I start flying again, I'd have it a little bit. Second Master Worlds, and I'm in the bullpen, which is where they, you know, they kind of gather everybody right before you go to your mat. I'm first match of the day or first group, right? And I'm sitting there and I'm like, I start like kind of trembling. I'm starting to like, can't breathe and my mouth's getting dry and I'm like kind of dizzy. And I just stopped and I looked around and I was like, this is amazing. Like I'm out here competing at the pyramid, like all like black belts, as far as the eye could see. Like that was all you could see. Just all these amazing black belts, all these guys I looked up to. And I was like, this is really cool. And also I'm one of these guys, you know, like it's not, I'm not even like watching from a distance, like, oh, look at all this here. Like I'm like standing there and I'm kind of like, kind of in the club, you know? And I just smiled, just put a smile on my face. And I was like, I don't care what happens. It's jujitsu. Jujitsu is easy. I do that every day. Like, this is awesome. Like, I'm fortunate enough to get out here and do this. And just looking at it that way, like, that I'm fortunate and able to get out and do this. Like, nobody's making me do it. There shouldn't be pressure on competing, right? It's, you do it because it's fun and you're able to. So I get over to my mat and I'm kind of stretching out a little extra, doing, you know, just some little warm-ups. And my buddy Ray, who was kind of cornering me, he comes up and he's like, all serious, like, hey, bro, are you okay? You know, because he kind of knew. And I was like, just couldn't stop smiling. I was like, dude, I'm phenomenal. Like, you have no idea. And I went out and I had, honestly, one of the best matches of my life. I stuck with my game plan. Also, I accidentally registered up in weight. And so, you know, and this was right before I went to Master 2. So I'm like the oldest guy in the bracket. I'm the by far the lightest guy in the bracket because I'm basically competing up two weight classes because I'm a light middleweight. And I had a great match. I hit the takedown I wanted. Everything in my game plan worked the way I wanted, minus this guy was just better than me. Mm-hmm. He was faster, stronger, younger, and better at jiu-jitsu. Like, I'd do a move, he'd counter, I'd counter, he'd counter, I'd counter, he'd counter, I'd counter, he'd counter, and I didn't have any answers for that.
Yeah.
Like, he extended my game plan as far as my knowledge base went. He beat me. He won the match in the end, but it was a close match. And he went on to smoke the next guy, like, just murdered him. And then he lost on a ref decision to a 3-time world champion the next match.
Wow.
And then 2 weeks later, he won Abu Dhabi pro black belt division. So I felt great. I was like, wow, that was a good match for me. Like, it was slim margin. But it made me come back and it just expanded on my game plan. I was like, okay, this guy did this when I got here. Nobody else has ever done that. So I had answers for, you know, like 3 or 4 different positions of just places I had never been, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was awesome. But, you know, I still had a little anxiety here and there competing. But these last few tournaments I've gone to, I've been pretty free and clear. Same with flying, you know, in flying, it was weird because I'd realized like I have no control.
Yeah.
Like what happened before, that was on me. I know that was on me. That doesn't exist anymore. So any anxiety I have, like, I just have to let it go because either the plane's going to land safely or it's going to land not safely. Like, it's not on me at all. Like, I have zero control. So what happens, happens, right? But when I was going into jiu-jitsu matches, my thought process had to be the exact opposite. I couldn't go in and go, well, whatever happens, happens, because that means I just either I go and lay down and I, you know.
Yeah.
So whatever happens is on me. Mm-hmm. I have to go out there, be very intentful of exactly where I want to be, what I want to do, and I have to make it happen. If it doesn't happen, I tried. No big deal. And so just kind of thinking about it that way, you know, like number one, I'm happy to be here. I get to do this. It's a privilege. You know, my things in my life are going in a direction that allow me to spend money and take time off and come compete. Right. So, and then I'm out here. I want to do it. Otherwise I wouldn't spend my time and money doing it. And then it's just on me. I go, I do it. And if things work out, awesome. If they don't, I wake up the next day. I'm not hurt. Everyone still loves me the same or hates me the same. Like, you know, there might be one guy that's like, I beat Klingerman. Yes. Post it on YouTube. That's actually how I started a YouTube channel, because the only matches of me online were the few guys that beat me. And I was like,
That's good motivation.
Yeah, that is good.
I was like, I guess I gotta put matches online now. I'll just put a highlight out.
So this has been great, but before we let you go, there's always one more thing. Do you have any on the mat and off the mat tips for us?
No. Yeah, sure. So I knew this was coming. I prepared and I didn't come up with anything. But as the conversation went, I think, you know, so often the on the mat and the off the mat tip are almost identical, right? It's because everything in jiu-jitsu applies to both. They apply on and off the mat. So I would say, you know, on the mat and off the mat, just enjoy where you're at. Be thankful that you're there. Be thankful you're able to be there, that you're in a place in your life that you're able to train when you're on the mat. And, you know, I always tell guys, like, look around the room. Nobody on the mat wants to be somewhere else. Everyone in the room, this is where they've chosen to be. This is where they want to be. You know, there's no unhappy people there. And then, you know, off the mat's the same. Like, if, like, just be fortunate that you're where you're at. And if you're not happy where you're at, it's up to you to change it.
And I think with that, we'll just wrap it up.
Yeah. So where can people find us?
You can connect with us. Well, first of all, if you have not subscribed to the podcast yet, go ahead and subscribe so that you do not miss a new episode as soon as they drop. And you can connect with us on Instagram at Beauty and the Gi Podcast. And I'm also hanging out there at Brassy Broad Jen.
And I'm AJ Klingerman. You can also find us on Facebook at Beauty and the Gi Podcast. And you can join our group, Beauty and the Gi Gang. And of course, subscribe to our YouTube, which finally has some videos on it with some techniques. So
good.
Sometimes that gets hard for me. Like, I get in my own head a little bit, even though I coach so much against it. I get in my own head a little bit. So sometimes it's hard for me to do those videos, but we finally have some videos out there.
Yay. And we love hearing from you. So send us a DM on Instagram. Let us know if there's any topics that you want to hear us cover in future episodes. Just let us know what's on your mind and where you're listening and where you're training and what you're working on.
Yeah. And after listening to James today, I think we're going to do a future episode on game planning. I think we should really dive into that a little more.
I think so too.
Come back for that.
Exactly. And we'll see you
on the mat.